Hello and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. Hi, I'm Ashwani and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
My name's Brooke and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
We're delighted to be joined today by Catherine Davies from SLT for Life. Catherine is a speech and language therapist, and I'm going to hand over to you really to explain to our audience what it is you do and what speech and language therapy actually is.
Yeah, thank you, Ashwin. I'm really pleased as well that you've invited me today. So a speech and language therapist works with a variety of communication and swallowing difficulties with clients following a brain injury. Regarding the swallowing difficulties, that can be broken down into different levels of difficulty, and there's all sorts of different consistencies of diet and fluid that somebody may be recommended to have depending on the nature of the delay and the difficulties with the different stages of swallowing. And this is difficulties again that have occurred following damage to certain areas of the brain and the cranial nerves involved in eating and drinking. Sometimes people are non-oral, fed via a peg, and they may have some taste.
Can we just explain what a peg is for those who don't know?
Yeah, so a peg is a tube that goes into the stomach and provides all the nutrition and hydration. And sometimes if the swallowing difficulty is too severe, somebody will be consistently peg fed. However, sometimes people are combination fed, an introduction of oral trials. There's a lot of therapy techniques and strategies and manoeuvres to support encouraging the muscles to regain strength, and a speech and language therapist would be the main person involved within the rehab of the swallow.
And why is swallowing important? I know it's something that we all do instinctively without even thinking about it, but what is it about swallowing in particular? What are the risks involved if somebody has an impairment with their swallow?
Yeah, there's significant risks, because when none of us actually actively think about swallowing, it's just something automatic every day. We're also swallowing our saliva hundreds of times a day. If there's difficulty with swallowing, as soon as the swallow is triggered, nobody can control the speed or where the food or fluid goes. So if the muscles aren't ready to close the airway, then there's a significant risk of food or fluid entering the airway. The airway then may become, you get infections because it's a foreign body into the lungs. And that can lead to pneumonia, which is obviously life-threatening. So it's a really an area that there's a lot of risk assessments around and a lot of caution. And speech and language therapy is heavily involved and asked to review swallows and the mechanisms involved.
Is that something that everybody with a brain injury suffers with? Because I don't think I had an issue with swallowing.
Yeah, no, it's not. I think there can be sometimes issues following if somebody's intubated, because you will struggle to swallow them. But post-intubation, so the tracheostomy, yeah, sometimes people don't have any difficulty, or they may have a very slight assessment and progression to normal diet and fluid, but it's very minimal. So that area is often kind of forgotten, not particularly forgotten, but not a big picture of your rehab journey. So it really can vary depending on the difficulty.
I think I remember when this was a speech and language therapist going to get involved, I remember thinking that I don't have any problems with speech and language, but then again, I think that reminds me of the fact that I didn't really know what my difficulties were, and it was a lot of other people told me, and somebody actually told me early on that I should have videoed myself, and I really wish I had done, because I always thought I was fine. But my parents and my support worker told me that I used to speak really low. Really, I was really quiet and had no intonation in my voice. Is that common as well?
Yeah, that's very common and relates to the communication difficulties. And I think, again, there's the fine line between having insight and videoing in the right time for that. Because I think sometimes if videoing, speech and language therapists use videoing and recording quite a lot, especially within the dysarthria, which is the area you've had work on, which I'll describe in a minute, to gain insight. But if it's done too soon, it can affect somebody's confidence.
I was going to say confidence of a thing as well.
And I think that can then be a little bit detrimental to mood and confidence. So it is a fine line. And the therapist it is a good measure to look at where you were and where you are now, especially when it's subtle changes as you're progressing.
My family and friends and stuff, the people that I saw every day, they wouldn't and myself, I wouldn't really notice any difference because it was day on day. But if I didn't see somebody for like 6 weeks or something, they would like always make a big remark about how much I'd improved.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think it's the subtle changes day to day that people don't see. You especially don't see yourself.
Especially at that early stage when your recovery is quite rapid.
And I think everybody's self-monitoring and awareness of themselves is different. You know, I think when we all hear our voice recordings, we think, you know, do I sound like that? So it's, we hear ourselves differently in our head as well. Everybody does.
There's also that element of denial as well. There's denial that you've had anything wrong with you and you're trying to prove that you're fine.
And that's a massive area that I'll discuss around kind of cognitive communication difficulties and the overlap between speech and language therapy and OT, occupational therapy and psychology.
I remember the first thing I'd had done was an assessment. I was told to name as many words as I could, beginning with the letter F and S and C. And all I could think about was words beginning with F and S and C, which work particularly, which you shouldn't say in a professional basis.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like blocking my thought process.
Yeah.
So I actually ended up saying them just to get out of it.
And I think listening to you, it's really nice. You're almost explaining the things that speech therapists would say. Words that are not always appropriate are the ones that are stored and accessed much easier.
Yeah.
You know, I've known people with very, very severe aphasia, which again I'll explain in a minute, and they've had no speech, not able to form words, find words, but swear words have come out. I think it's because we're very conscious not to use them in day-to-day life. They are almost stored separately, so they're easily accessed.
I wonder if that also plays into things like lack of inhibition following a brain injury.
Yeah, because the cognition, the behaviour, again, plays a large part in the communication skills.
I remember being surprised at how much speech language therapy has to do with the brain and the process of thinking. So I was thinking at first that my speech was fine. I can speak, I can say words. I didn't realise how bad they sound. That's where the video would come in. But I just remember I had these exercises to do, and it was like we had to name as many things. It started with nouns, adjectives. And so the many nouns you could do connected to a bathroom, say toothpaste, bath, shower, whatever, they were the easy ones. And then it was like adjectives, which was like, I don't know, brushing, scrubbing, cleaning. But I think the hardest one were like emotions.
Yeah, because they're more abstract emotions.
Yeah.
They're not very kind of, the words that we use less frequently.
Yeah. And it,
and they're not related to objects, are they? So no. The emotions are hard.
I remember thinking, this is really, really hard. And that's when I first got into it, because I could feel being able to access words more clearly. And it was making you think and try and think, like, how on earth do I think of an emotion connected with the bathroom and stuff like that?
Yeah.
It's just like, and I was really, really thinking hard. And I remember after the exercise, I was totally exhausted and thinking it was, you know, some good had been done there, whatever it was.
And that's the cognitive fatigue, so the fatigue of the brain, which I'm sure the occupational therapist and psychologist has covered as well. And this is, again, that multidisciplinary working. So I think what you've done there is really nicely show the differences in the role of the speech therapist. So you've talked there about the dysarthria side, as in what your speech sounds like to people. So if I just go into a bit of detail around dysarthria. So dysarthria is a difficulty or a weakness with the strength and speed of oral muscles. So when we talk, our tongue and lips are moving several times just for one word, because every single sound we say, the mouth needs to do something differently.
Yeah.
So following a brain injury, if the cranial nerves have been affected that affect the strength and speed of the oral muscles, if things slow down in our head, we want to say things as quickly, but the muscles can't quite get there.
Mm-hmm.
So some people naturally slow down, which you may have done, or sometimes sounds are missed because people are trying to speak as quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So then it will massively change the intelligibility of speech. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I was going to say stairs, but I miss out the sir or the ter. It would be tears or sairs, right, which are completely different words.
Do you know what? I can really strangely relate to that at the moment because I've got a girlfriend who's Spanish speaking and I'm learning Spanish and she's helping me with my Spanish homework. And rather than just getting her to do it for me, which I have, which is quite tempting, she's really good. Like, we were doing it for 2.5 hours last night. I'm saying a word, like, I don't know, habla. And I think I'm saying it fine. She's like, no, no. And she's making me do it again. She's making me go through the vowels and we're going, ah. And she's going, ah. And she's going, ah.
It
almost sounds like absolute craziness, right? If you overheard our conversation last night, which going, ooh, ooh. And she's like, no, no, ooh. Ooh,
yeah, so to you it probably sounds exactly
absolutely
the same.
Yeah,
so that's another level, isn't it? And again, that's a great link because, you know, I wouldn't be able to teach somebody Spanish, so no. So like, within my role it'd be, but again, if the mouth has changed shape, can't form the sounds, vowels can be completely different. And if we look at accents, people's accents, they're all, if you break them down, it's the vowels that often change the accent of speech, and sometimes people can almost have a different accent as well. So within dysarthria, as you're saying, there's the forming of all the individual sounds, there's the breath support as well. So sometimes breath support's reduced, so there's somebody can say as much on one breath. They may be breathing kind of from upper chest, and we teach diaphragmatic breathing. And there's looking at pacing, so there's a lot involved. And I would say with the dysarthria, that's where insight is really needed. So I've worked with people, and if they've got really, really significant and severe cognitive, so thinking difficulties, really, really poor attention, it's going to be incredibly difficult to be as successful with the dysarthria because you do have to have that awareness to be able to carry over. It's always the carryover of skills into conversation that's difficult.
I had that big time. Lack of concentration. At first, everybody's like really sympathetic with you and everybody's, you know, really, you know, enthusiastic. And I used to be as friendly as possible and really enthusiastic. And I was used to people saying, oh, you're doing great. You're doing fantastic. And you do. You lap that up. You kind of love it. And I remember this endocrinology nurse. I remember her saying to me, your concentration's not very good, is it? You know, if I saw like a CCTV camera or something, you know, I would have probably realised that, I was changing subjects and not staying on the same subject or anything. So, and that was sometimes like, it's quite like tough love, isn't it? I remember that was really, really useful for me because, not everything's sunshine.
Yeah, and obviously people want to kind of highlight the positives in your recovery.
Sometimes you probably also need
the reality check.
Yeah, exactly.
There's still some way to go.
And again, there's a fine balance between that because I've also worked with some clients that don't lap up the praise, you know, and that's quite difficult for therapists to deal with because we do really naturally praise people because we are really pleased with progress
that
people
are doing. You've done all your work.
Well, it's yourselves that are doing the work. We're just guiding. And this one particular really didn't like praise and would then criticise more, you know, that they still had difficulty. So that was kind of liaising with psychology and what phrases to use to support that person without, you know, over-praising.
So, coming back to the dysarthria, you've talked about what it is and the difficulties that can follow. So as a speech and language therapist, then what kind of exercises do you do? What other sort of rehabilitative methods do you employ to improve that?
Yeah, so we would do an in-depth assessment where we would look at certain movements for the tongue, lips, the palate, breath support. And we also look at the voice box, as in, you know, can somebody change pitch, can they change volume? And then we analyse where the deficits are and have very specific exercises we would do for the areas. So for example, if somebody's struggling to lift the tongue up, there's a lot of sounds like t, l, n from the top of the tongue. So we would be doing repetitive exercises. So with dysarthria, it is very repetitive, the therapy. It's quite intense. It's recommended regularly. So as you said, a support worker, somebody being able to support that on a daily basis.
Yeah, because we had like with the speech and language therapist I had, Lucy, she's like set like set homework, if you like, to do. And then we used to do that with support worker.
Yeah. And it's quite a set hierarchy we would work through within the difficulty. So we would look at strengthening the muscles in isolation. So that's just lifting the tongue up and down, strengthening lip seal with certain specific exercises. Then we would move to a sound, maybe a sound with a vowel. Then it'd be single words. This is probably everything you went through. Reading paragraphs. And the real difficulty is that carryover into conversation. Mm-hmm. Because as we're all talking, we're just subconsciously thinking of words and how we're formulating the message we want to get across, rather than how am I breathing? What's my tongue and lips doing? So it's kind of almost got to become automatic. So that's why it's such repetitive practice.
It's reminded me of something there. Like, I remember thinking, like, when I was started speaking to people, I remember, like, in your normal life, you kind of have, like, an auto cue of what you're going to say next. It was as if somebody used to just rub it out all the time. Yeah. So I was, like, dealing with that as well as dealing with trying to sound normal and stuff. And I just remember having, this must have been, like, a lack of confidence or whatever, but I remember thinking, I'm just really boring. People just want to get away from me. I'll do this person a favour and get away from them, because what would you want to speak to me for? I've got nothing to say. I don't do anything interesting, especially when I suppose it happened to me at a time. Like, my friends were like progressing in their careers. I had ones moving down to London. I had ones, applying for different jobs, for them becoming teachers. Just all these exciting things happening in people's lives. And I was learning to say, ooh. And then, I just thought, why would anybody want to speak to me?
Yeah, because your life had dramatically changed, hadn't it?
Massively slow
down. The same as your friends, and then everything, as you say, but you were obviously very motivated to engage. But, you know, I think all of us professionals that work with people with brain injury, we advise, we have the knowledge to support, but we will never fully understand what somebody's been through because, you know, that's a unique experience, isn't it?
I had this, like, amazing story to tell, but after that was told, I hadn't done anything. What I thought was not anything of note. And your life was just so different from everybody else's. Everybody else has got, like, you know, people getting, like, finished, you know, applying for jobs, getting for the first mortgage, people having kids. And, like, I was doing things like speech and language therapy, just making different noises and stuff. Yeah. And, like, I just thought, why would anybody be interested in me from that?
And you engage. Some people, you know, may not have engaged. You know, when I've worked sort of NHS and more of the acute phase, it can sometimes be really difficult getting people to engage because your life's completely changed. You know, what are these things I'm now being asked to do? You know, last week I was doing such things. That's a real credit to yourself that, you know, that you were motivated, you engaged really well, and that's, you know, how you've then significantly improved.
Yeah, I still do now. I still have massive confidence in that because I just feel like I'm so far behind people, you know, everybody else, and I just think, you're paranoid that people think because I only work part-time and stuff, I just think people just have such a low opinion of me. When I know for a fact that they don't, but it's difficult. It's one thing knowing and one thing believing.
This is a bit like the episode we had where we were sort of about not comparing yourself to others.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still do that. I know you shouldn't.
And it's really, I think, you know, it's probably easy for people to say that to you. It's believing that, and I'm sure that's something that neuropsychology are able to support.
Yeah.
Because this is something I'm sure we do all here all the time, and can only imagine that, you know, and actually we've got a lot more resilience than people who haven't had to go through a journey like that. And it's the social norms, isn't it? So if you're saying I only work part-time, that's because in your head you're thinking, well, social norms to work full-time.
But then, you know, who else goes out doing public speaking and running, you know, crazy marathons and whatever. So.
Well, the belly would tell us that.
Learning Spanish.
Learning Spanish, absolutely.
I've, my priorities has changed at the moment, but I will get back to marathon running help.
And I think with you saying you have to think about things, that's a completely valid point. You know, as I said, even with the dysarthria, it's with all areas of communication. Following a brain injury, everything has to be thought about, which must be incredibly tiring.
And your brain is... It's got to do the most work that it's ever had to do, but it's the least capable of doing it. So everything just takes so much longer than it would.
Yeah.
And by the time you've thought of it, you've forgotten what you were talking about anyway. So.
that's a great phrase, isn't it?
You were just like, all right, yeah. And then you just kind of back out of conversations and you realise you're kind of stuttering at people. And then you just think, this guy must be just it must be just a really awkward situation. I'll let him go, and then you run and hide. Oh, there's something I wrote about in. I remember seeing somebody I knew. I can't even remember who it was. I just remember the process of this happening, and seeing somebody walking down towards me in the down the main street. And I remember jumping into a shop just to hide from them, just to excuse. It wasn't particularly to excuse myself. It was to excuse them of the awkwardness.
So again, I suppose that's you. As we said, that's about you perceiving how other people might think, what they may think of you, rather than what actually happened.
I had this stammer. I've never, ever had a stammer before in my life. And it was just like, it was horrible. It was just like you're trying to speak and it just doesn't come out.
Mm.
And it's just, I've got so much more empathy for anybody with any... it just opens your eyes, doesn't it? It makes you, I guess, a kinder person. You do understand that be kind thing.
And I think, what you're describing there is kind of all the areas of communication. So the areas that speech and language therapists work with is initially we look at somebody's level of attention.
Yeah.
So can somebody focus? Can they maintain attention? So can they understand? Because before, if somebody needs to attend and have a certain level of attention, to be able to listen to information and be able to process it. And then we look at how much somebody's understanding. So is somebody now only understanding single words? Are they only understanding nouns? And we would look at this via formal assessments.
Mm.
And then we kind of work on a cognitive neuropsychology model, neurolinguistic model, where we look at kind of input and output. So we would then look the same at written language. So what can somebody read? Can they read as they did before? Do they recognise the letters?
Mm.
Can they read single words? Can they read? And we do a lot of, word to picture matching to identify that. Again, if somebody couldn't read prior to their injury, that's completely different. Yeah. What we look at is how somebody was before and compare that. And then we look at the word store. So, which is, we kind of have a word store in our head. So if I think of the word tree, so I've said the word tree, but we're all imagining what a tree is. We know what it does, where it is, where a tree is, what it looks like. And they're all that's the semantic information.
Mm.
And that's the area where you were being asked to describe things in a bathroom. So we'll think of the word bathroom, we imagine what a bathroom is, what's in there. Then a more abstract area that is emotions linked to that, as you were saying.
Yeah.
So we've kind of looked at the input, what somebody understands both by listening and reading, what's happening in the word structure. So are they able to access words? And that's where we do the category naming, as in things in a bathroom, fruits, vegetables, and we progressively get harder.
Yeah, I could see how it was like branching out and how it was sort of feel like making new pathways in my brain almost. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And I often say it's a little bit like when you went from A to B via a motorway previously, it's now going on the A road.
On the A road,
So we're building.
New pathways, but it takes longer obviously on the A roads, doesn't it?
And it's just accessing and it's strategies as well. So I'm sure... Not only did the therapy work on category naming, because by doing that you are creating the pathways, but there was probably strategies involved as well, as in, you probably recommended to describe a word if you struggled to think of it, to kind of draw it. There's other ways.
Yeah.
Where, and I often, to kind of make sessions a little bit more fun as well, we'll do games as in, what am I, who am I, where somebody will explain something and you guess who that person is. Is, or you ask the yes and no questions. Am I an actor? Am I female? And it's, it's getting the brain working. You're still generating words and you're thinking of questions and it can be quite fun. And then from the word finding, again, there can be difficulties with the output, getting the words out, forming the words. So there's the word finding, which is being able to, tip of the tongue, I've got the word there.
Mm-hmm.
I can't find it. I know it, but I can't get it out.
Yeah.
And then there's the forming of the words, which is, are they clear? Is the dysarthria there?
Yeah, so there's two.
Yeah, there's also something called a dyspraxia, which is more of an incoordination of muscles. Mm. So we identify that more as a groping around for sounds. So a dysarthria is often more of a slurring. And so the words there, it's similar, it's sounding like it.
Mm.
Tree would sound similar to tree. It might just be
T or
slurred. With dyspraxia, it might be more D, cli, and the groping around. So that's actually trying to coordinate what the sounds are within a word. And we also look at writing as well. So how can somebody, you know, can somebody spell? So the physical part of writing is more of the occupational therapists and the physiotherapists.
Yeah.
But the being able to know that a B is the shape of a B, or, yeah, you know, the word cup is C-U-P, and they can write. So again, we can have a prescriptive therapy program looking at spelling.
Something that just triggered a memory then. Like, I remember I had to, I can't remember what it was. I think it was in the bank, getting a new bank account or something. And I was asked to sign my name. And I was like, I can't remember my signature. I'd forgotten my signature.
Yeah.
I had to make a new one up.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know if that's anyway linked to speech and language therapy.
And I think, you know, often being able to write your name, a signature, address can be a, can come to you quicker than others. So it may have been that other areas of spelling were difficult for you initially as well.
It's just so many. I think the thing is, there's so many things going on at once, isn't there?
There is. Yeah. And that's, and I think you're giving really nice examples that are enabling me to describe the role. And I think, you know, that's the air with speech and language therapy. People, you know, I still now sometimes have people say, I'm not sure why I've been referred to a speech therapist. Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes it's very obvious. And I think an area I very much specialise in, I work with people from kind of just post-coma stage to, you know, very severe up to very high level, which is probably some of the areas you were working on, which is your very subtle, higher level language difficulties. So interpreting and understanding humour. So this is more of your cognitive communication.
Humour, that's a big thing, yeah.
Yeah, social skills is a big one that I work on with clients. So again, how you perceive others and what you think they think about you.
Yeah.
Emotions is a massive one. So not just naming an emotion, but actually picking up and identifying emotions in others. And I find there's often quite noticeable changes in social skills post-brain injury. And these are not always identified initially. So sometimes a client may be referred to me further down the line, you know, after you've had occupational therapy, physiotherapy, psychology. And sometimes it may be colleagues that have worked with me previously that think, oh, I've seen Catherine work with clients with this before. And I use a lot of questionnaires, which sometimes highlights people. So it'll be a social skill questionnaire, you know, do I give the same eye contact, yes or no? You know, do I recognise emotions?
Eye contact was a big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I have struggled to initiate conversation? Do I struggle to stick to the point, the topic, as you were saying before? So that can combine attention and also a social communication skill.
Eye contact without looking creepy.
Yeah.
You can overdo eye contact,
yeah,
can't you?
Yeah, now, because we mentioned it, don't
we? Yeah, I'm like, well, looking, yeah.
Yeah.
But on the subject of humour, I was allowed my mobile phone. I'd nagged and nags from a mobile phone. It was 2007, so not really, they weren't really as big as they are now, but I had this mobile phone. My mate Graham sent me a joke. I think the joke was something to the sound of, somebody's just offered me some venison for £10 a kilo. Do you think that's deer? And obviously, that's the joke, isn't
it?
And so I had a discussion going with everybody in my ward. There was like six guys in my ward, whether this price was expensive for the venison. So he decided it was okay. So I said, no, that's okay, back mate. And he must have been like, what? It was a joke.
And that's a great example of literal interpretation. Yeah. That's what we see.
Yeah.
You know, that I'll see it all the time. And so it's again, and you might think, well, how do you therapy that? How do you work with that? But it's just by kind of exposure, explaining situations, teaching abstract language, reforming.
Yeah.
Information, you know, because I think if somebody had deficits previously, so if, you know, if somebody before the brain injury, you know, had severe kind of autism on a spectrum and didn't understand humour and had significantly impaired social skills, then that would be quite difficult to work with. Because again, we're looking at what were the skills like previous to the brain injury. How were we restoring the skills?
Because you don't know the person previous to the brain injury.
But we get a lot of information. So when I do questionnaires, I will also do questionnaires with family members, because somebody might put no change, no change, no change to everything, and the family are going, you know, lots of change, lots of change. So then that's kind of trying to subtly increase the insight, and that's kind of going back to the beginning conversation, wasn't it? As in, what's, you know, that fine line of insight? Is it, you know, should we be how much should we let somebody know initially without affecting their mood?
Thank you for listening to part one. We hope you can join us for part two. Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.